Hello and welcome to The Week in Art. I'm Ben Luke. This week, how photography is at the core of feminist activism. Jacob Rothschild remembered, and a Robert Ryman painting in Paris. For International Women's Day on the 8th of March, the South London Gallery is opening the exhibition Acts of Resistance, Photography, Feminisms and the Art of Protest. Activism and photography have long gone hand in hand, of course, but this collaborative exhibition, organised with the Victoria and Albert Museum, attempts to capture a new chapter in this distinguished history with a particular focus on feminism across the world. I talked to Sarah Allen, the head of programme at the South London Gallery, and Fiona Rogers, the V&A's Parasol Foundation curator of women in photography, about the show. The financier, philanthropist, collector and leader of cultural organisations, Jacob Rothschild, died last week at the age of 87. I talked to Anna Summers-Cox, the founder of the art newspaper, who interviewed Rothschild on numerous occasions about his impact on the visual arts and heritage. And this episode's Work of the Week is Adelphi, made in 1967 by Robert Ryman. It's one of around 50 pieces by Ryman in the exhibition The Act of Looking, which opened this week at the Musée de l'Orangerie in Paris. Guillaume Fabius, the co-curator of the show, joins me to discuss the painting. We have a new subscription offer for the art newspaper, up to 50% off our annual subscription packages. If you subscribe before the 14th of March, you'll receive our bumper April issue with a Venice Biennale guide, the Art of Luxury magazine, our annual attendance figures report, and a supplement on the Expo Chicago Art Fair. Do also subscribe to this podcast and our sister podcast, A Brush With, wherever you're listening. And please give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Now, to coincide with International Women's Day this week, the South London Gallery opened the exhibition Acts of Resistance, Photography, Feminisms and the Art of Protest. It's a collaboration with the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, whose collection of photography is one of the largest and most significant in the world. The exhibition looks at global developments in photography over the past decade in relation to feminism and activism, focusing in particular on the way in which feminism intersects with broader issues, including trans and indigenous rights and the climate emergency. It includes several works in which social media and digital technology are used as tools for societal change, a key factor in what has been termed the fourth wave of feminism. Inevitably, the show focuses on numerous key events in recent history. They include the US Supreme Court overturning of Roe v. Wade, the ruling that stated that the Constitution of the United States generally protected the right to have an abortion, anti-rape protests in Bangladesh responding to the rise in violence against women and girls in 2020, and the ongoing protests against the regime of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the wake of Mahsa Amini's death in police custody in Tehran in 2022. Sarah Allen, the head of programme at the South London Gallery, and Fiona Rogers, the V&A's Parasol Foundation curator of women in photography, are the show's curators, and they took me on a tour. Sarah and Fiona, before we start talking about particular works, I wondered if we could talk about the collaboration, because this is the V&A and South London Gallery working together. Fiona, you're dealing with collections. Sarah, you're dealing with a Kunsthalle, an exhibitions venue. Tell us about that collaboration, Fiona. Do you want to start?
Well, actually, it's probably more relevant for Sarah because she was the one who devised the initial exhibition, and then she approached me, knowing the new role that I had at the V&A, looking at women in photography and trying to, you know, address some of the gender imbalance in the collection in our programme. So really, it was all Sarah's idea.
Well, knowing like Fiona's very long work in the area of women in photography and all the fantastic work she's been doing through Parasol, it felt like a perfect kind of moment to collaborate. And also two institutions doing different things on different scales, it kind of maybe allowed Fiona to work in a different way and allowed us to work in a different way. And yeah, it's just been fantastic to be able to do that.
Why is it a particularly important moment to do this show now? I mean, obviously, you're opening on International Women's Day, which is when people will begin hearing this. But why do this show now?
I mean, I feel like very lucky that I have this role and this focus. But I think, you know, obviously, historically, women have been overlooked by most of the major institutions. And so for me, it felt like a great opportunity to activate on some of the thematics that we've been focusing on with the V&A's Parasol program, and you know, quite a lot of the work we've been collecting and working with, and the artists that we've been collaborating with have been quite political artists. So it sort of felt like for me that was a good time to do a show that looked at some of those themes. But also, obviously, the world is on fire.
I was going to say, it's a moment of crisis too.
Yeah,
in
and
so
I think
many ways.
The show, one thing to note about the show is it's super contemporary. So we're looking at the kind of period circa 2010 to the present day. And so we're dealing with issues that are very current, very present. Protests in Iran, the reversal of Roe wage, you know, all these things. So much has been achieved in relation to women's rights, but we can't be complacent about that. And I think the last 10 years have shown us that. So this constant need to platform these artists and to be having these discussions. So
it feels an especially international exhibition, and that seems very deliberate, Fiona, in the sense that just in the sight of where I am now, we've got Bangladesh, we've got Iran, we've got the US. So there's a sense in which this is a global struggle to a certain extent.
Yeah, and I think we were very conscious also, you know, to white British women that, you know, we wanted it to reflect what was happening globally and, you know, the contemporary issues that women are facing every day. But we also wanted to reflect this idea of, you know, sort of fourth wave feminism and sort of challenge some of those concepts and look at maybe where the parallels are for women globally, the sort of, you know, transnational solidarity and as we move to sort of more intersectional feminism. So a lot of the artists look to those different themes.
So Sarah, can you define fourth wave feminism? It's a much debated topic. There are books about this subject. But yeah. Fourth wave feminism in relation to third wave feminism. And also there's a sort of crisis in feminism to a certain degree too. There's a huge debate, particularly in the UK, for instance, in relation to trans rights versus gender critical feminists and so on. So again, it seems a particularly acute moment to address feminism and how artists are responding to it, right?
100%. I guess fourth wave, like as we said, is very debated. Academics haven't really written about it, probably for the reason it's too early, really, to kind of historicise it in that way. But I suppose some of the emerging concerns of this so-called fourth wave is primarily the emergence of the internet and social media as an avenue of activism, as a space of consciousness raising as well, space to organise. You see that come out through some of the artists like Hoda Afshar and also Sophia Karim. So the internet is really key, but also the point you make about really foregrounding intersectionality. What is the nature of interlocking oppressions? That is really defining the fourth wave. Of course, it did also in the third wave, but ever more increasingly important for artists working in the last 10 years. Right. And you see that come out through the show as well.
Absolutely. And you see the internet writ large, literally in the imagery, don't you? So it's not just that people are researching on the internet, but there are literal, let's go and look at this piece over here by Sophia Karim. I'm looking at a bag here, which has a Twitter post on it. So tell us more about this work.
Yeah, so actually by trade, she's an architect. And funnily enough, she was one of the Jameel Fellowships that we run with the V&A. We run a prize with the Jameel Foundation. And this work has actually now been acquired by the V&A within our Asia department. But this work also looks at, about global solidarity for women. And she's using internet-sourced, open-source material or working with photographers that are actually predominantly male photographers that are on the ground in places like Bangladesh, documenting protests and female uprising. And this is a work called Turbine Bar, which is, it was the largest gathering of women in our lifetime, but, you know, generally quite underreported. And so this work sort of seeks to highlight some of the uprisings and the protests that the women were having across many different topics, you know, the caste systems, but also the rape in Bangladesh, different rules that were governing India at the time. And so she's producing these samosa bags as a kind of a vehicle, I guess, to get the work to travel further afield.
Right. And the samosa bags almost comes from a kind of chance event, Sarah, where she was served a samosa bag which had this sort of scrap of paper,
100%.
Which was used to form the bag. And she thought, it's almost like she had a sort of an epiphany being served that this could be used for art.
Well, absolutely. And the fact that the bag was court proceedings. And at the time, her uncle had actually been imprisoned. He's a photojournalist as well. And she was wondering, you know, am I going to see the court proceedings of my uncle appear on a samosa packet? And so it was, like you say, that light bulb moment where she then thought about how I make art. That connects kind of transnational struggles as a way to kind of support artists too, because a lot of the images are other photographers that she works with. So she's getting their photography out into the world and having them credited is really important.
She even accesses recent photography in relation to Israel-Palestine in the last two bags on this shelf.
Absolutely, yeah. She's very active and very vocal on that area. And, you know, it's activism on varying registers in this show. And on the back of that particular bag we're talking about is her daughter's homework. So there's kind of this, you know, mixing of activism and life. And you see that come out through many artists in the show. The two things are very interwoven.
Of course, one of the biggest movement for protest among women is in Iran. So mm-hmm. can you tell us more about this really dramatic work which hangs in the centre of the show by Hoda Afshar? It's an amazing piece because, again, there's the internet social media aspect on a screen, which is on a sort of plinth, but then these vast photographs. Tell us what we're looking at here.
Yeah, so Hoda is Iranian-born, but she's been exiled to right. Melbourne. And so a lot of her work looks at the idea about displacement and migration and being exiled. And this is a piece called Intern. And this is her referencing social media activism, and in particular the anonymous images that circulated in the wake of the death of Mahsa Amini in 2022. And a lot of the source material that was being shared by the Iranian community, but also by diasporic women and women that just wanted to sort of show solidarity, were lots of images of reference to hair. There's quite a strong reference to the Kurdish freedom fighters who braid each other's hair before they go into battle. There's also sort of symbolism around doves. So there's a lot of sort of references to birds and to freedom and to this idea of martyrdom.
And those were directly referred to within the protests, and she's picked up on them.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why within the installation there is a tablet that has these social media images that she's collected on a rotation, which is positioned within her installation of her own photographs, which are staged photographs of her and her friends plaiting each other's hair with some doves and some sort of releasing of white birds, which became a kind of funeral emblem.
Sarah, you mentioned the fact that this show has a very intersectional outlook. Mm. On the other side of where we're standing now are these amazing, really dramatic, deeply poetic, but profoundly disturbing images, which relate to the women's struggle in relation to climate change and the climate emergency. Tell us more about them.
Absolutely, yeah. So we're in the section of the show called Feminist Futures. So within this section, we're talking about Pulumi Basu's work. And so it's a speculative fiction. What would the world be like without the power and the spark of women? And as you say, it's quite a desolate landscape, quite dystopian. So trying to make the point that the world would kind of wither and die without kind of investment in women and girls. And, you know, Pulumi is someone who spent their whole life campaigning for women and girls. And she partnered with WaterAid for this particular commission. So again, in this section, we see artists partnering with big charities or big institutions as a kind of tactic to amplify their message.
One of the things that's really striking is there's a sort of magic realist tradition that she's operating in. And it's about using modes which have been both literary, filmic, and then in terms of visual arts, of course, but re-employing them for a new purpose in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the artists, you know, obviously protest and photography and activism have a long and kind of complicated history. But I think what's interesting about the artists that we have in this show is that a lot of the work is informed, A, by their own upbringings, their own lived experiences, but also they are artists that are using different kind of creative strategies to subvert or to challenge the idea about, you know, the kind of concept of looking and othering. And a lot of the work is performative, a lot of the work is working with communities, their own communities, self-portraiture. And so I think, yeah, a lot of the work is challenging what the idea of protest photography or activist photography looks like.
They're really interesting textures throughout the show. I wonder if we might go and look at this vast wall of what look like snapshots, effectively. And this is a work which directly relates to the Roe v. Wade decision that you referred to earlier on. Tell us about this one, Sarah.
So Carmen Wienand is an artist I think both of us have wanted to work with for a very long time. And, you know, that's been one of the joys of bringing the show together. We've been able to bring in these amazing female photographers that we absolutely adore. And Carmen is certainly one of them. And this work, it's basically like an anti-decisive moment. I mean, a lot of activist photography is about the decisive moment, the moment that you capture, the moment that changes history, all
which
that kind of...
Which is Cartier-Bresson's quote.
Exactly, Cartier-Bresson's quote. And this is like anti-decisive. This is like the mundane day-to-day activities of what it actually means to run a feminist workspace. So these are abortion care workers who have been doing the work for many, many years in America, in the Midwest. And, you know, it's just their day-to-day tasks, their office work, you know, birthday parties, all the kind of texture of life, basically, as a kind of homage to care and labour, and also as a kind of, it's in contrast to the very over-sensationalised imagery that you see in anti-abortion campaigning.
That's right. The sort of everydayness, Fiona, sort of somehow increases the poignancy of it. If you even dwell for a brief period and look at, say, 10 of these snapshots, you build up a picture of how broadly it is affecting women across America, right?
Yeah, and I think what Carmen is trying to unpick is, what does women's healthcare look like? This kind of idea about hidden labour, mostly hidden female labour, but also what does the overturning of Roe versus Wade mean for workers? What does it mean for a female workforce? What does it mean for, you know, an entire generation of women of reproductive age? And this idea about this mundane, everyday, what does she call it? The work of the work.
Yeah.
Let's go into the next section, which is all about the way that contemporary feminisms relate to history. And you've got a film in this section by Tourmaline and Sasha Wartzel, which is about Marsha P. Johnson, who's an absolute hero of the trans movement, of course, of the wider LGBTQ community and so on. It's actually wonderful in the sense that it involves different textures, that, like we were just talking about, in the sense that there's found footage of Marsha P. Johnson plus original footage. Sarah, tell us more.
Yeah, I think that just nail on the head there about the texture of this work. And I know Tourmaline worked very closely to get that found footage, and it's very rare footage. And so it's amazing to be able to see
it. I was amazed to find it.
Yeah.
I lit up the minute I saw it, because I didn't know it existed, you know.
Hearing Marsha speak, it's just kind of phenomenal. And of course, as you say, such an important figure in the history of transgender activism and gay liberation in the US. And I suppose the inclusion, not only because Tourmaline is an artist who's been very squarely working in the area of artist activism for a very long time, but we're kind of trying to make the point of the importance of transgender activism to feminism, and that the two struggles should be seen as feeding each other. And I think that was really key to this work's inclusion in the show.
Was it important then, Fiona, to make a stand on that issue, which is, in some parts of the world, it's more decided than others? We're in the UK, where there's a terrible debate going on about it. Was it important for you as curators to make a stand on this issue, to actually put a work out there which clearly illustrates the importance of the trans struggle to feminism more widely?
Yeah, I think so. But I think sort of more than that, I think it was just important that we acknowledged that, you know, feminism has a long and complicated history, and that it has been informed and influenced and supported by many, many different communities, and it's interwoven. You know, we also have Zanelli Moholy represented as well in the show. So it felt very important that, you know, beyond the kind of trans question, it was important to acknowledge that, you know, the histories of feminism have been deeply interwoven, but also, you know, a complicated history with the queer community. And, you know, both have had, you know, different struggles and have sort of come together in different forms of solidarity. So I think it was to acknowledge that history.
We've now crossed over the road. We're in the fire station, the other part of the South London Gallery, and we're in a work by Raffaella, or Rosie Rosella. Sarah, do you want to tell us about this piece?
So within this room, we've got a couple of elements, basically. We've got a very large archival wall on the back, and then we have a three-channel video installation. And Raffaella is someone who's brought to my attention by Fiona, so I might pass over for her to give a little bit of a brief overview. But just to say, one of the reasons that I feel that this pairing is very nice is because Raff is dealing a lot with prison abolition, all the women in her life that have gone through the prison system in Australia. And so a lot of the themes are very diaristic kind of photography, subjects that are really, really close to her heart, documenting her community, her family. And she's in dialogue with Nan Golden, who's just across the way, who again is a very diaristic photographer, documenting her tribe, her community. And the themes of addiction as well come through in both. So just wanted to give a little bit of a note to where we're standing and kind of the dialogue between these two rooms. But I will hand over to Fiona to say a little bit more about Raff.
Yeah, I adore Raffaella. I think she's one of the most interesting artists that I've come across in the last 10 years. She's just got this incredibly thoughtful approach to working with communities that have been historically marginalised or othered, you know, working a lot with First Nations women who are now disproportionately affected by the Australian judicial system. But I think what is interesting about Raf's work in the context of the show is that it really is doing this work about kind of flipping this concept of photography. And it's really kind of challenging what activism or protest photography looks like. And looking at how an archive or a collaborative way of working can create a site of resistance.
Right.
So all of the work is, you know, work that she's taken, or it's photographs that the women in her family, her sisters, her community, that they've taken as well. And it's mixed in with, you know, court records and different ephemeral material that relates to them being within the prison system. Mm. And it's trying to challenge what that looks like and, you know, giving a kind of personality to these statistics, but in a very, very kind of thoughtful and collaborative way. And I love it. I think it's a really powerful way to tell a really complicated story. And this is, you know, it's 15 years worth of work. Mm-hmm. It's part of her PhD. She has a, you know, very kind of strong sense of sort of social care towards the women. Everybody is co-credited as mm-hmm. being a co-creator of the work.
You were talking about the anti-decisive moment earlier on, Sarah, and it seems to me that this is absolutely that writ large, but it also speaks to the expansive definition of photography that you want to really push in this show, in the sense that we've seen very grand installations of the highest level of production to a certain degree. We've seen snapshots. Now here we have again, it's a wall, but here the kind of very informal language of photography that Raf is using is interspersed with handwritten texts, with found materials and so on. So it's about expanding the definition of photography to a certain degree as well, and what photography can do and be in the 21st century.
Absolutely, you're just right. We're trying to really give a platform to those artists who are rethinking what photography as activism looks like, who are pushing that in the contemporary moment, as it does have that domestic feel. And we were delighted to put it in this space because it is a domestic space. We've got the radiator, we've got the curtain. It just has that really homely feel, and all of that comes out through the kind of handwritten notes. And, you know, the archive is so important to Raf, like the power of the archive. And of course, like the idea of prison and the kind of, you know, archival documents that would relate to all the women that she knows have gone through the prison system. And how can we counter that? How can we create a counter archive, something that centres like care and love and creates a more gentle representation of life against that kind of bureaucratic system? And the other fantastic thing I should note is that, like, this work has actually led to reduced parole sentences. It's been used in courts, so it's taken outside of the gallery and becoming like an actual act of resistance in the real world.
Fiona, picking up on what Sarah's just said, this idea of photography as an actual benevolent force, that is to say, it is not just an aesthetic means of representation, it has an active role in people's lives. And it strikes me, looking all across the show, that so much of it is deepening social situations rather than trivializing, which is so much of what we see in terms of like media and so on. It seems to me that you're making an argument not just for the breadth of photography, but for the importance of photography today.
Yeah, I mean, I think photography is increasingly an important medium because it's a accessible medium that everybody has access to, and, you know, it's such a part of our daily consciousness, our lives. But I think because of that, it is something that can potentially be overlooked in terms of its ability as an art form. I feel really lucky that in the context of the V&A, we're really investing in photography. You know, we've just opened a major new wing for photography at the V&A. It's a department of more than 10 people now. So I feel like this is, it's a big part of our lives, and I think it needs to be reflected in what institutional policies look like. And particularly these kinds of works have been the things that have been sort of historically overlooked by major museums and institutions, because it's difficult work, and those sorts of stories, the stories of women, have largely been bypassed and marginalised in favour of other things. I think what the show does really well is it shows that photography as a medium, or lens-based work, because obviously we have a lot of films, you know, it can stand up and it can have an aesthetic that, you know, is really incredible, but it can also carry really important stories. And I think that comes back to photography's ability as a kind of storytelling, narrative-based, when it's used properly, when it's in the hands of people that know what they're doing and have a kind of, you know, deeply collaborative and respectful process.
Because we devour photography now. With the onslaught of images you have to take in every day, it's really just overwhelming. But what I find interesting about a lot of the work in this show is it kind of forces you to slow down. It's the pace at which you're going to be able to take in this photography is a lot slower. You see that in Raf, you see that in Laya Abril, Shada Soleimani. They're really problematizing the way we consume photography, the way it's been disseminated, the way it's been weaponized against women, against LGBTQIA people, against people of color. So these are group of artists who are really thinking very critically about the medium, photography as one of the premier mediums of protest, but really thinking about what that means today. What could it mean in the future?
Well, Sarah and Fiona, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Acts of Resistance, Photography, Feminisms and the Art of Protest is at the South London Gallery in London from the 8th of March to the 9th of June. Coming up, Jacob Rothschild remembered and a Robert Ryman painting in Paris. That's after this week's news bulletin. A Paris court this week found that the French-American dealer Guy Wildenstein guilty of tax fraud and sentenced him to 4 years in prison, two of which are suspended. He was also fined €1 million. Wildenstein is the president of the Wildenstein & Co. Gallery in New York and the patriarch of one of the industry's most established art-dealing dynasties. Today's verdict ends a lengthy legal saga centred on Wildenstein hiding a vast art collection to avoid paying a hefty inheritance tax bill. In the same ruling, the court also gave Wildenstein's nephew, Alex Wildenstein Jr., a 2-year suspended prison sentence and a €37,500 fine. The case concerns the estate of Daniel Wildenstein, Guy's father, who died in 2001, and Alec Wildenstein Sr., Guy's brother. The Court of Appeal found them guilty of concealing an enormous estate via trusts. In addition to various properties in Kenya and New York, the assets included paintings valued at €1 billion, including those by Bonnard, Fragonard, and Caravaggio. Alec Sr.'s widow, Lyuba Stupakova, was given a 3-month suspended sentence for complicity in money laundering. More than half the countries that signed a declaration endorsing the Washington Principles, a set of standards meant to guide the return of art looted by the Nazis, have made minimal to no progress in returning stolen property in the 25 years since the principles were drafted, according to a new report released by the World Jewish Restitution Organization on Tuesday. The Washington Principles encourage countries to identify and research cultural property that may have changed hands during the Second World War and to return work that was looted, confiscated, or sold under duress. Of the 47 nations that endorsed the 2009 Terezin Declaration relating to property seized during the Holocaust, 7 have made major progress, 3 have made substantial progress, 13 have made some progress, and 24, including Brazil, Denmark, Spain, and Russia, have made little or no progress. A circular stone plaza in Peru is one of the earliest known megalithic structures in the Americas, archaeologists have revealed. Located at the archaeological site of Calakpuma, 550 kilometres north of Lima, the plaza was built around 4,750 years ago and may have had a ceremonial function. The Calakpuma Archaeological Project began excavating the plaza in 2018. Their work revealed it to be formed of 2 concentric stone circles with an external diameter of 18 metres. The ancient builders stood each megalithic stone upright, close to one another and without using mortar, in contrast to many other Andean plazas of a similar date, which were constructed from stone masonry walls. The plaza may have been ritually closed sometime between 500 and 200 BC. To read these stories and much more, visit the website or the app. Now, Jacob Rothschild, a leading figure in the British art world as patron, collector and leader of institutions including the National Gallery, National Lottery Heritage Fund and Waddesdon Manor in Buckinghamshire, one of the last surviving great buildings constructed by the Rothschild family, died aged 87 last week. Rothschild had a career as an investment banker that was impressive even by the standards of the famous banking dynasty from which he came, but his impact on the world of visual arts and heritage is what makes him a singular figure in British culture over the past few decades. Anna Summers-Cox, the founder of the art newspaper, interviewed Lord Rothschild on numerous occasions over the decades, and I spoke to her about his impact. Anna, before we talk about Jacob Rothschild's achievements in the arts, you knew him, you interviewed him several times. Tell us about your memories of the man.
Highly intelligent, quite diffident, but at the same time exceedingly aware of how intelligent he was. Oh, he was above all a clever man. He came from a really clever family. He was also not particularly rich until, personally rich, until quite late on in his life. And he, while of course he lived in considerable style, I mean, he had a butler and all the rest of it, he was certainly not the kind of person who went in for nightclubbing, yachts and so on, like his son. One evening I was having a drink with him and his son, Nat, stormed in and said to him, "Are you going to the party?" Wherever it was, you know, in the next 2 days. And Jacob said to him rather dryly, "No, it takes too long to get there." And Nat said, "Well, why don't you take a helicopter?" Jacob said, "That's a real waste of money." because he was annoyed because he knew that his son was showing off and he wouldn't have taken a helicopter anyway. You know, he was an old-fashioned English gent. He wasn't jet set and he certainly didn't want to be a celebrity.
Right. And that sort of money management, as it were, was a crucial part of his life. He was clearly somebody who had an idea of how to run organisations, and they might be those closest to him in terms of personally, in terms of the Rothschild property and so on, but also public institutions.
Well, I mean, he did something absolutely radical with the National Heritage Lottery Fund, of which he was the first chairman, because he'd realised that what had emerged in the previous decades was that there was a kind of split between art historian, directors of museums and management, and a kind of caste struggle between them. And he thought, well, this is not a good way to go forward. So when people were putting in for the lottery funds, not only did they have to raise 25% on their own account to show that there was local support for whatever it was and that they were competent, but at the same time, they had to produce a business plan for the future to justify whatever it was that they wanted to do. And they could only get the money for sort of capital projects and expansions and modernizations, to which most of the directors went, "Duh, how do you do that?" And he said, "Well, I will give you funding to employ management consultants." So they suddenly got a crash course in how to actually do forward planning. So this meant that British museums, I mean, big, little ones, all learnt to get over their fear of numbers, projections, you know, organisation. That was an incredible change. He did that in just 4 years because he looked at this great wallop of money and thought, we can't just hand it out and let people spend it in a feckless, arty way. People have got to learn how to direct things.
Right, and it was curious, wasn't it, because, you know, he was running the National Heritage Memorial Fund, which was a much smaller organisation concerned with grants and so on. And basically, the British government and others realised that there was no organ for sorting out lottery funding, which was this new thing which had come into British culture at that time. So it was kind of thrust upon him to take up that mantle, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was somebody who enjoyed seeing challenges, things that could be improved. And he wanted things to be lasting. He didn't want something just to happen and then that was the end of it, you know. You know, Wadsden, for example, which was his big house, he wanted there to be proper curators so that things would be studied and communicated. And he also taught me something about PR, which was quite interesting. One of the first things they bought with the National Heritage Lottery Fund was the Churchill papers. And there was a huge scandal in the press about this. You know, what are they doing, paying the family of the former prime minister for papers, which should be public property anyway?
It was sort of 13 million or something like that, wasn't it? Yeah. It was quite a lot of money at that time, especially.
And he was a bit shaken by that. And I was talking to him about that afterwards. He said, well, after that, I realised what you had to do. You had to actually just keep passing out lots and lots of little press releases about little small projects, at which point the press would get really bored and they would stop looking at stuff coming from the National Heritage Lottery Fund. You know, swamp people with too much information if you don't want them to pick on stuff. I've never forgotten that. That was really, really clever stuff.
It was probably only you and Martin Bailey, our illustrious colleague, that actually did keep reading the Manor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He was, of course, chair of the National Gallery in London at a particularly sort of tumultuous period for the organisation, or rather he took on the National Gallery just as it was in the wake of a tumultuous period around the Sainsbury Wing and the previous building, which was called the Monstrous Carbuncle by the then Prince of Wales and now King Charles. What do you make of what he did at the National?
I mean, Jacob is a modernist, but he is not a wild modernist, and he certainly would have thought that the proposed extension was pretty ugly. I mean, this is a great thing about rich people. Rich people know each other and they trust each other. So he got together with his friend John Sainsbury, you know, head of the Sainsbury family, and said, OK, well, what can we do about that? And they got Robert Venturi in, who did that kind of concertina neoclassical extension, which is, you know, polite, as they say. But it resolved a very sort of awkward moment because actually, what the Prince of Wales had said expressed what a lot of people felt, and really quite sort of illustrious people felt, but nobody had dared say to before, because the sort of the orthodoxy was everything has to be modern, different, you know, a new statement. And just very quietly, you know, well, relatively quietly, shall we say, that new building appeared, and it caused great excitement at the time. And now nobody can quite remember what the fuss was all about, you know.
Well, now the fuss is about that polite building being taken apart.
Exactly, yeah.
And of course, in that time, the National Gallery didn't just expand. It seems to me that he was quite instrumental in the way that the gallery was refurbished and the way that it now looked. And it sort of set the plan, in a way, for that original building to be put back to the sort of grandeur of its original form.
Yes, that was a discussion that had been going on for a few years. The question of taking historic buildings back to something like the original state at the time was a live issue, again, because it was an evolution from the obligatory modernism of the 50s and 60s and so on. For example, Timothy Clifford, director of the National Galleries of Scotland, hung some of the galleries with silk and regilded stuff. And I remember, you know, terrible insults were fired at him. He was told it's whorish, you know. It was considered really quite shocking. So historic buildings got spruced up a lot. I remember the entrance of the National Gallery, which had been very downplayed, was suddenly, you know, the mosaics were played up. And Jacob hung his main gallery with green silk, which is what it was supposed to be.
And of course, there's the connection with the British Museum too. And there too, Neil McGregor was director of the National Gallery when Jacob Rothschild was the chair. And then again, they collaborated at the British Museum on one of the things which I think is the most almost exciting element of the kind of visual manifestation of Jacob Rothschild's influence in British culture, which is the Wunderkammer, which is right by the entrance of the British Museum, and a kind of wonderful space which you've written about, Anna.
Yeah, well, Jacob is the descendant, of course, of the European Rothschild family, and there was something called Le Goût Rothschild, you know, the Rothschild taste, which was a combination of works of art from the Renaissance, neo-Renaissance works of art, and a lot of the Louis style, you know, but the authentic, not the replica.
Right.
And his ancestor had collected a Wunderkammer, which meant a lot of extremely precious objects in the manner of the Wunderkammers collected in 16th century Germany. And it's been left to the British Museum, but was rather sort of underplayed. So Jacob, one of the things he did want to do was for the Rothschild contribution to the history of art to be honoured, as it were. So he did say, you know, if I give the money, will you redisplay it properly and in a better place? And of course they did.
Yeah, that's right. It was apparently, I don't have a memory of this, but apparently before that it was rather sort of unceremoniously sort of bunged into a room upstairs and nobody really went there, sort of thing.
Yeah, I remember it.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about Watterson, because that's in a way his biggest and longest lasting project, the family home. There were, of course, 44, is it right, Rothschild mansions, but this is one of the last remaining sort of grand buildings of its kind that lives on today, if you like.
Supported very amply by the Rothschild Foundation, because it was given to the National Trust in the 1950s. And when his cousin died, the National Trust sort of didn't really like it very much. I mean, it's a 19th century building in the style of one of the chateaus of the Loire, in a very continental feel of it, because it's got so much Louis furniture, which the English have always been slightly suspicious of, a little bit, you know, maybe a bit whorish. But of course it needs to be shown in the full glory, in 19th century glory. So, you know, the deep carpets, the flowers, perfectly lit and so on. So Jacob decided that he was going to make it as good as it possibly could be, and also expand the space so that the other collections could be shown, other Wunderkammer things. He got in proper curators. He continued the programme of publishing the collections. And Jacob was a complete sucker for high technology. And Adam Lowe's capacity to make unbelievably precise replicas inspired him. So he didn't have a good painting of Madame de Pompadour and so much, you know, circles around Pompadour. So he got the original painting copied. And then he had great fun because he put his small version of it next to the big one. And he asked people to judge which they thought was the authentic one, and just, you know, to press a button. He really loved engaging with the public.
Indeed. And he was a collector right from an early age, like actually many of his family had been. He acquired his first work of art at age 9, he once told you.
Yes, I think he was given a small fund, Simon Bussy, not a household name by any means.
No.
But certainly, he wasn't a sort of obsessive collector, but if he saw something nice and an opportunity, he would buy it. I mean, for example, he had a very large collection of classical vases, which suddenly came up somewhere. He bought the whole lot. Edmond de Waal, he liked, partly because he also liked Edmond de Waal's hair with amber eyes. So, you know, he liked the man.
They had a Viennese connection, didn't they? So they obviously saw each other as kindred spirits to a certain degree.
Yes, yes. There's something else I'd like to bring up, which is the question of Somerset House. You know, the fact that one now can go into Somerset House, that the courtyard is not full of cars, that it is a place for art and so on, is again due to Jacob Rothschild, because one forgets it was built to be the centre of the civil service. Mm. It was the civil service. And there was a very eccentric property developer in California called Arthur Gilbert, who had a huge collection of silver. And he'd fell out with the Los Angeles County Museum. So Jacob persuaded him to donate the whole lot, and he was then made Sir Arthur Gilbert. And then Jacob used that as the lever, together with the lottery fund, to get the civil servants out of Somerset House in order to turn it into an art centre. And then he got his friend, Lily Safra, I mean, as I say, the rich like to give to the rich, to pay for the fountain in the middle. And the rest is history.
Right, exactly. So he had a flair as well as the funds and as well as the kind of business now. So he combined all of those things to be quite an important and very effective philanthropist. Because there's no guarantee of effectiveness in terms of philanthropy, is there?
No, not at all. I mean, sometimes people say it's so wonderful, they gave their collection to the museum. Then you discover that it's all tied around with extremely vain conditions. Oh, it's all got to be put together in one room with my name on it, you know, that sort of thing. Jacob would never have thought like that. And he was a man who believed in activity and things going forward.
Going back to contemporary artists, he's been depicted by Freud and Hockney, who, of course, are two of the sort of best-known artists of their generation in the UK, but also, for instance, commissioned Juana Vasconcelos to make a very elaborate and quite fun sculpture outside Wadson. So he had a sense of fun in it all as well, and wasn't afraid of extravagant gestures, even if he was quite modest in other ways.
The first Vasconcelos sculpture was a sort of enormous pyramid made up of Chateau Lafitte bottles. Chateau Lafitte, of course, belongs to the Rothschilds. So, you know, it was all interwoven. That was rather like him, actually. It was the public spiritedness interwoven with the sort of the gloire of the Rothschilds, but not his own personal gloire. That's the important thing. He was a modest man.
Lastly, I wanted to touch on the fact that there was a project that he was deeply invested in personally and in terms of money, which was the library in Jerusalem, which he actually never saw opened. It opened in October, but he never set foot in it. It was a Herzog and de Meuron building, and it did open quietly, as it turned out, without much ceremony, after the events in Israel on the 7th of October and the response from Israel. Did you get the chance to talk much to him about Israel? Because he was connected to lots of projects in that country.
The family had been Zionist from the beginning of the last century. They were great supporters, and the Yad Hanadiv Fund that they had, foundation, contributed the major buildings of the State of Israel, the Knesset, which is the parliament, the Supreme Court, and, of course, the new National Library. I didn't speak to him in the last few months before he died, but it must have been deeply, deeply sad for him, because he was a man who wanted Israel to be a successful country and a happy country, and he believed in the Zionist dream. And what happened must have been really, really shocking. The only thing I know about the library and him was that he said to me there was a competition and all the Israeli architects put in for it, and just really nothing was quite up to scratch. So I just, you know, went to government and said, I think we should have Herzog and de Meuron. And so they said, yes, I think we should too.
You know? Right, okay.
I mean, that is how he dealt with things at a very high level.
I mean, aside from his obvious commitment to and connection to the State of Israel, he did always try to help Arab projects as well, I understand, and funded educational projects and so on, and apparently intended that Jerusalem very much to be accessible to people from every faith, etc. So he was not just purely a Zionist. He wanted peace in that territory. Is that right?
Well, I think the trouble is that the word Zionism has now become a dirty word, but it wasn't 100 years ago. And of course he wouldn't. I mean, he was as open-minded and as generous to everybody in Israel as he would have been in Britain, or as indeed he was in Britain.
Okay, well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can read our extensive obituary of Jacob Rothschild and Anna's interviews with him on the website or the app. And finally, it's time for the work of the week. The Act of Looking is the title of a new exhibition at the Musée de l'Orangerie in Paris, exploring the long career of the US painter Robert Ryman, who died aged 88 in 2019. It's the first major presentation dedicated to Ryman in France since 1981, and it includes more than 50 works, including Adelphi, a painting made in 1967. Guillaume Fabius is the co-curator of the exhibition, with Claire Bernardi, the director of the Orangerie, and he told me about this landmark moment in Ryman's distinctive career. Guillaume, where was Robert Ryman when he made Adelphi, both in terms of his career and where he was working?
Well, at this point in his career, Robert Ryman was still in New York. He's very much of a New Yorker, even though he was born in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. But he had his studio in New York, was really working in that place. But in his career, he was working for a decade now, but he wasn't that recognized yet. He did some couple of group shows. He met some other artists, whether it's abstract expressionists or future minimalists, basically. But he was in the point where he was still working very much on his own.
And that's one of the things to really emphasize, that he didn't identify with any school, really. He's always grouped with minimalists and conceptualists and so on. But he was very much an individual artist, wasn't he?
Exactly. He knew a lot of minimalists. He worked with Donald Judd and Sol LeWitt at the MoMA. He was neighbors with the Mangolds and Eva Hesse. Mm-hmm. So he knew all those groups and artists. It was really close with them. But he felt like he didn't relate with these conceptions of art at that point. He was very much of a painter. He was basically the only minimalist painter, if we would classify him as a minimalist. But he refused to be lumped in a group. He said about himself that he was very much of a realist, because everything is real in his paintings. Just paint, but it's real.
That's the thing that's really difficult for some people who don't get Ryman to understand, isn't it?
Yes.
They're like, what's it about? And there's a misconception so often with his work that it's somehow blank. But for those of us that are enthusiasts, it's so loaded. There's so much going on. Yes, there's
exactly.
there's a kind of narrow field of inquiry going on. But it's so intense, that engagement with paint, and particularly with the colour white.
Definitely. It's full of everything. He's basically observing and working on every part of every painting, whether it's the support, the surface, the light, the way to hang it, the space around it, which is also like a very huge concern for him. And that's what's happening also with Adelphi, the work we have at the show. It's a lot of things to consider, basically. And that's why it feels, when you don't really know Ryman, it can be easy to think it's a blank canvas, but it's really not. And there's so much to tell about every canvas.
So tell us more about Adelphi then. It is on canvas, but there's this very important element, which is wax paper. Tell us about the form of the painting.
So Adelphi was made in 1967. It's a large free canvas painted white, of course. But the important part is basically this kind of frame, which is not really a frame. It's also part of the painting. It's wax paper that's beneath the free canvas. The installation process is that we put the wax paper, kitchen wax, mm-hmm. really,
yeah.
and have it taped with painter tape.
Yeah.
In a free way, the instructions were very clear that it has to feel intuitive.
Yeah.
And then the free canvas is stapled to the wall through the wax paper.
Right, so the wax paper kind of sits behind. It's a frame, but it sits yes. behind the canvas.
Yes, that's why it's really interesting to say it's a frame, because usually frames go really around and sometimes over paintings. And this one is really beneath, so that's what is put forward, is really the canvas and the paint. But it has this kind of frame, which was really what he was working on at that time in the late 60s, how to integrate the paintings on the wall. So every kind of frame, there's also a lot of work from this period where there's blue chalk, there's a work called Orin at the Colin Mueller Museum in Ottawa, which is framed with blue chalk on the wall. So that's something he was really working on, and that's something that's also, in terms of context, that's an interest for a lot of artists at the time.
And one of the things that it does is it sort of de-emphasizes the object, because one of the things about Ryman that's interesting is that he obviously perceived that so much of the abstract work that was being made in and around that period and by his predecessors in the abstract expressionist movement was about objecthood.
Yeah.
And he wasn't interested so much in the object. Of course, his paintings were objects, but he's so obsessed with the paint, isn't he? He's obsessed
yes.
with the physical stuff of paint. And by reducing the objecthood, he kind of re-emphasizes that to a certain degree.
Definitely. He was really much of a painter. Some people call him just a minimal mm-hmm. artist. Some people say he's kind of a blue-collar worker because that's how he worked. Mm-hmm. But he really tried to underline that he's a painter. He works with paint, the materiality of paint, and all the elements that compose a painting. So that's what he does all through his career, even with the most radical artworks. It's still a painting. It's not an object. Mm. It's a painting in a traditional way, but with new experimentations considering the way it's hanging, the frame, or the kind of paint also.
He really labored over the works. You hear, when you read his quotes about the works, you realize his experimentation with brushes, with the liquidity of the paint and so on, was incredibly intense. And these things can look almost casual or light in terms of the amount of effort that's gone into them, but actually there's a tremendous amount of time and energy that has been employed in the making of these works, isn't there?
Yes, beforehand he really thinks about the protocol that he's going to use to paint. So he's going to choose a specific kind of brush with a width that's going to change between paintings. He's going to choose the kind of painting, the amount of paint he puts on the brush. So it's really kind of menial, a tedious work that he does, especially for large formats that we have here at the show, mm-hmm. that feels very minutious, kind of a time-consuming way, but also very reflective of the way to paint, because you can see the movements and the thought that went behind that seems simple, but that's really not over-complex, but very direct and honest about the work, about the paint.
Absolutely. Now, the painting's title is Adelphi.
Yes.
And therefore, you may assume that there's some sort of meaning in that title. Is there?
No, there's never a meaning in Ryman's title. A lot of them are untitled, really. Mm. But in the 60s, he starts series that may have a name that's sometimes the name of the paint or the support. Sometimes it's very descriptive. There's the size of the canvas. And there's all these kind of random names that he uses that really don't hold any kind of specific meaning in a way. For him, it was really much about identifying the works in a very administrative way.
Yeah.
Okay, this is this one, this is this one, because they can sometimes look so much alike that he needs to have this recognition, this archive, this inventory of his own paintings.
Now, he showed this in Germany for the first time. And the interesting thing about Ryman is that although he is seen as a sort of great American painter today, he achieved recognition in Europe just as much as he did in the US at that time, and perhaps even more.
Yes, that's what's really interesting. As I said earlier, he was really working for a decade at that point and really already found his formula of the white square. But he really did group shows, really. In 1967, he had his first solo show at the Paul Bianchini Gallery in New York. But he wasn't really a success. He didn't sell anything.
Right.
But he was really glad to have his own show because he felt like he wanted his work to be shown alone, to have the full, I want to say, might of his work. But at the Paul Bianchini Gallery, Konrad Fischer and Heino Friedrich went to see Ryman and they loved it. And they both invited him to exhibit in Germany, so in Munich and Dusseldorf. That was a point that's really kind of a turning point, especially in Europe, because these exhibitions allowed him to have curators to see him and to invite him to some shows. So he had his first institutional retrospective in Amsterdam as a Stedelijk just a year later. And then he was part of those landmark shows for minimalism and conceptual art in Bern when Attitudes Become Form,
yeah.
which are really kind of the defining moments in history of art with these kind of exhibitions that define a movement. But as we said earlier, that it's interesting because he was in those shows, but he's really kind of around it. He was not really invested in these making history moments when artists and curators were all looking to find ways to have an impact on art and the public as well. And Reimann was basically just there and he was fine with it. It's really interesting. But that's really the moment when he got the recognition after really more than a decade of work.
That's right. He wasn't sort of era defining. And one of the things I've heard about him is that he didn't really have ambitions to sort of compete with artists around him or in some way to insert himself into the history of art. He was just so concerned with just making the work.
Yes.
And then, yes, of course, he wanted to continue making it and show it and so on. But there weren't sort of grand ambitions about his place in art that he wanted to achieve.
No, that's what we really like also about working with Reimann. He has this humility on his own work and in his own person as well. He's just a painter and he paints and that's just what he does. And that's really interesting because he's in a moment, in a context that really, especially in New York at the time, that's really, there's a lot of things going on, especially in art and all kinds of art as well. Mm. And he's hovering around and really going to work at 8 in the morning and painting and then going back home.
Yeah.
that's why some people like to see him as a worker, blue-collar worker, because he's as humility and hands-on practice.
Absolutely.
That he likes. The thing is also with his formula of the white square, it's infinite. So he has to keep going to find new ways to rearrange the fundamentals of painting through the white square. So that's why he has to keep going every day to work. But the thing is, his work also needs to be shown in galleries and institutions and museums because he has this really peculiar way to have his artworks hanged on the wall, what we discussed with the frames, for example. Mm. So he's really working on the frames, the space around the works, the lighting.
He needs particular conditions for his work, doesn't he?
And definitely.
One of the things I've always been struck by is that Reimann's work, if you see it in a group show, it's great. It works wonderfully in its own way. But when you see them all together, there's something amazingly impactful about that. And you must have experienced that as you were hanging this. And seeing Adelphi
immensely
alongside its colleagues, you know, alongside these other works, it really makes a massive impact, doesn't it, when they're all together?
Exactly. And that's what we heard about also with the public, is that it's difficult to see a lot of Reimanns in the same place. And that's something, I think, to see the full extent of his career is really something that's necessary to understand his practice. Because when you have so many artworks, we have almost 50 artworks from all his career, seeing all of them shows that it's not just a white square. It's so much more than that. Really, it's a basis. It's something that's it's a formula that reveals so much more. And when you have just one or two, maybe you can see, there's a difference. It's very minimal. And when you see him with other minimal artists, it fits with them. But seeing him, only him, and with so many different artworks from different time periods, it really shows what he wanted to do, that it's exploring paint. Really. And it's as easy as that. That's why it's important to have many artworks.
And lastly, of course, you're showing him in the Orangerie. And Reimann was a bit tricky about influence, wasn't he? Obviously, he had looked at the history of painting and so on. But he kind of resisted the idea that his work had hard and fast influences. But why is it important to show him in the Orangerie? And what does it do, if you like?
That was a really important discussion that we have with Claire Bernardi, who's the director of the Henri and co-curator of the show. How do we present him in here when he said he didn't have any influence? But that's his terms, and he was working as a museum guard for almost a decade at the MoMA, and he saw everything.
Yeah.
He saw all the modern masters, so he's mentioning sometimes Cézanne and Matisse and Monet. And also he saw what the MoMA was buying at the time, so a lot of the abstract expressionists, especially Rothko, that he's really a major source of influence. Mm-hmm. But when asked about him, Reimann tries to really scour away from that and really, no, I'm just doing my own thing.
Yeah.
But it's evident that when you've been this close with art for so long, that you have some kind of influence.
Yeah. it seeps in, even if you don't want to acknowledge it. Yeah.
Yes, of course. That's really like water.
Yeah.
But at the Orangerie, what was important to show is that Reimann is already part of art history, and especially in the history of painting. Mm. And because we have these amazing rooms, these amazing artworks that had Monet's water lilies, we felt like it was really important to fit Reimann in this history, but not as a filiation, like he was inspired by Monet. That was not the point, but really, how do we look at painting after Reimann, even artists before him, especially Monet with the work of light, of matter, of series, that almost a century earlier is very different in terms of subject, but the practice is kind of similar in the way he works paint, really.
Well, Guillaume, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Robert Reimann, The Act of Looking, is at the Musée de l'Orangerie in Paris until the 1st of July. And that's it for this episode. You can find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Tan Audio, and on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. The Week in Art is produced by Julia Mahalska, Alexander Morrison, and David Clack. And David's also the editor and sound designer. Thanks also to Daniela Hathaway and to our guests, Fiona, Sarah, Anna, and Guillaume. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.